History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've realized is they don't have to go untold. If we're willing to ask a few questions and invest a little time in listening, the idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we always come away with perspective we didn't have before. Perhaps you had a chance over the Thanksgiving holiday to hear a few memories from veterans in your life. And if not, maybe you can plan ahead now to work on that over the holidays next month. It's going to be a much younger voice that we hear from today. Next weekend will mark the 83rd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and our program will center around that. But today, we get to hear from a Marine Corps veteran who was there in Afghanistan for the controversial withdrawal of American troops. He's even written a song about those who tragically died. 25-year-old Greg Whalen is back in school now at Hillsdale College in his hometown in Michigan, where Hometown Heroes airs every Saturday morning and every Sunday night on Radio Free Hillsdale, WRFH. In fact, this interview was recorded in the state-of-the-art studios there, and I had to start by asking this young veteran what made him want to join the Marine Corps.
Really, the first thing that I still remember is when I was about 8 or 9, an older brother of mine enlisted in the Marine Corps. So that really set it off. Other than that, I think I had the typical fascinations of a young boy, machines, airplanes, stuff like that, but not necessarily like a career goal that I could articulate. But when he joined the Marine Corps, that really took hold of my imagination.
Yeah, and I'm curious what that represented, because I've interviewed a ton of World War II Marines and some Marines from the Korean War and the Vietnam era and some of the Cold War years, too. I'm guessing the Marines in that context, in that era, is different from maybe your generation here. So what was it about a Marine that made you want to be one?
So I didn't know much about the Marine Corps at all. Really, in my mind, the military was the Army kind of thing. But when he joined, kind of observing him and then getting books and just very quickly seeing into the way the Marine Corps talked about itself, the culture and the ethos is the big thing. The Marine Corps prides itself on and does a good job of putting out there. And so just the intensity and rigor that it claims to live up to really took hold.
Well, and maybe you can help us understand that. So give me a taste of when you were in high school here, you know, before you joined the Marine Corps, what were the biggest things or most exciting or challenging things in your life?
I think that probably would have been athletics. I think athletics for probably a lot of people is the closest that it comes to the kind of military intensity. So belonging to a team, the comradeship of being on a team, the physical hardships. So I did basketball and track. So definitely mostly running oriented. But that, yeah, I think that would have been the closest.
So did you think you were ready for what the Marine Corps was going to present to you?
I was definitely curious to see. I did think I was ready. Not obviously that it would be easy, but in working with the recruiter and everything and the workouts that you would do with the recruiting office before going to boot camp and that kind of thing. I was performing well. I was hitting the marks that I needed to for the standardized kind of scored physical testing that they would be doing in boot camp. So I felt pretty confident about it.
How'd that work out?
It went very well, actually. I ended up being the company honor graduate in boot camp. I didn't quite get the Iron Man award, which is the physical fitness. There's one other guy just ran a smoking fast 3 mile, and I could not touch it. So. But no, it went really well.
And had your brother given you any pointers or given you a taste of what his Marine Corps experience was like?
Yes, a very balanced taste. Obviously, I saw in him kind of the motivation and, again, kind of that culture of the Marine Corps. And he also did a good job of explaining that it's not all what you see in the ads. It's not all going to be fun. It's not all even going to be interesting. Trying to give a good... a balanced picture. But Yeah, no, I went ahead with it, and I had my own complaints for sure, but it went well.
Well, and anybody, you know, especially in this era when our military is all volunteer, right? There's no compulsory service in the United States for now. So this is a decision you made, but you had to weigh some of the risks. And how was that balance for you? Because I'm sure some people said, what about X, Y, Z? And there's the potential to be deployed, to end up in combat. How did you feel about that?
I don't know if this is, at least amongst the guys who I ended up being in the Marine Corps with, this is pretty standard, but that is the desirable part of it.
That's why you signed up.
It's very much, I don't know, I haven't had much experience with the other branches, to be honest, but definitely from what I saw at the Marine Corps, it attracts a certain kind of personality, and the goal is you want to go see combat, you want to go, and of course that's mostly, you know, that's likely an attitude of those who have not seen combat or the ones who want to go, but there is, that's part of it. So that was very much like the interesting and appealing thing. The fact that like you're going in for a purpose, it's very clear what that purpose is. It's fighting and hopefully winning wars. And that in the Marine Corps, you know, at least it's what the hope is that you actually will be doing that thing, that you're going to be prepared for it by the Marine Corps and as a Marine, and then you're actually going to do what you exist to do.
And I just thought of a question that I don't think I've ever asked a veteran. I mean, I'm thinking of over 1,000 World War II vets and quite a few from other conflicts. But your generation's different. So those guys grew up, they might play army in the yard with their friends and have little toy soldiers and imagine themselves in battle. But you're part of the video game generation. Is that something you did before you went in the Marine Corps? Play these games that simulate combat experiences?
We actually, growing up, there were no video games really in my family's, in the household. As like some of my older siblings started getting older, kind of getting their own computers for college and stuff like that, I started playing some things. But really, honestly, before joining, I had not spent all that much time on the computer. I had some experience with the games, but... Mm-hmm. Very much. We lived on 20 acres for a good bit of my time growing up, and I played outside. We'd go find sticks. We'd have toy guns, and so we were very much doing the playing outside, playing war kind of thing. Me and my brothers.
You're a throwback.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to get the contrast between what people think it is by playing the video game versus what you actually experience. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw a lot of your fellow Marines that brought some of that perspective to it.
Mm-hmm. The Marine Corps is fascinating because you're getting people. I mean, I remember one of my martial arts instructors, he was a young guy. I mean, at the time, he was probably 22. He grew up in like knife fights in Boston, like for his life. Like that was his growing up experience. And then you also get the people who have never really been outside to do anything. And they're kind of joining because they are realizing I'm missing something. Like I don't have a lot necessarily going on, or there's some kind of masculine itch that hasn't been scratched. So a crazy variety of people. It's very interesting watching that mix, but there's a lot of shattered expectations, I think, which can be both a good and a bad thing. And for myself, I mean, I experienced that as well, not necessarily with like the, what is a video game, make it seem like it's going to be or anything, but in terms of, when the Marine Corps is good at talking about its ideals, well, human beings are still human beings, and the struggle is living up to ideals. And so, depending on how idealistic you are, and I'm pretty intense in that way, there's a shattering of certain things and a kind of a rebuilding, a reassessment.
Well, I'm glad you framed it that way, because now you can kind of walk us through that timeline and how that evolved over time. But I have to come back to that initial motivation, because... Mm-hmm. You said it was the idea of combat that actually made you want to join the Marine Corps. But why? I mean, what mm-hmm. motivates that? What's the underlying priority or value that you hold that made you want to risk your own life in a situation like that?
Growing up with a strong patriotic background, coming to a school like Hillsdale Academy. I started at Hillsdale Academy in 7th grade and then through graduation. And having that education of what, again, what America's ideals are, and what it can be and ought to be, So there's a real love there of that thing, of the life that we have here. Perhaps it's a little naive, but it made it easy. It wasn't really this intense consideration of, oh my goodness, but like my life on the line kind of thing. It was pretty simple. Just like I have a desire for adventure and intensity. And then on the other hand, there's like these things mean a lot and are worth a lot. And so it was a very simple, calculation, I guess, in my head. And I think it seemed that way for a lot of guys. Just like there's a job to do. There are people worth doing it for.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to understand, especially, you know, it's a little disorienting for me too. Most of the veterans I interview are significantly older than I am, and you're significantly younger than I am. So I want to make sure I understand your mindset. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that it's just the idea of America, the values, freedom, liberty, the amount of importance you put on that is such that you're willing to risk your life for whatever representing that, preserving that, extending that meant.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely, with time, that would be qualified a little bit. So going in, it was very much that in a very pure sense. As time goes on, actually experiencing it, what is life like in the military? What is the U.S. doing in the world? Well, I wouldn't say that all those ideals, they haven't like gone away. I very much believe those things. They're a little more qualified, and I think the experience of going through it does make it more personal and less abstract. The people that you're doing it with become much more important in a way than the ideal, or at least much more present and immediate than the ideal. The people you're doing it for maybe as well. But I think absolutely those ideals hold.
And I think we're already getting some hints at some of the tension and conflict that you would end up experiencing internally when your motivation is one thing, but as you take stock of what's happening around you, you're wondering if what's happening fits the aim that you started out with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's hear it from your words. So you end up in the Marine Corps. It sounds like, you know, boot camp was a breeze for you and you sailed right through. What happened from there?
It was actually very quickly after boot camp. Boot camp helps if you're an idealist. Boot camp helps intensify that because it is the purest form of Marine Corps indoctrination that you get. And I mean that in a positive way as well. But right after boot camp is when you start realizing that's right. And it's something that our drill instructors told us would be the case, but then you start seeing it. They said boot camp will not change somebody's character automatically. They have to actually want it to and let it reform their character. And so very quickly after boot camp, you start realizing not everybody maybe changed in the way that I, you know, this is kind of self-centered, but in the way that I would have expected or would have liked to see. And then in myself as well, coming to grips with what is the Marine Corps actually in real practice in the world, not just in this kind of boot camp situation. So right after boot camp, I went to infantry school, Camp Geiger. I was East Coast for everything. So Parris Island boot camp, Camp Geiger, near Camp Lejeune for infantry school. And I was also sent to my first orders after that school were to 2nd Light Armor Reconnaissance Battalion on Camp Lejeune. Some of the difficulties there that kind of set a pretty bad tone for the next couple of years was that the 2nd LAR had just moved down to platoon-sized deployments. So they would attach only a platoon at a time to a given, essentially attach it to another unit that was deploying. And we could tell by, or at least it seemed likely, that the part of the unit that I was in was not going to come up for a deployment in the whole time I was going to be there for my whole enlistment. That, as well as there was a pretty bad culture amongst the younger, like the junior Marines, of just like, we're just here training. There's no deployment. There's no war. Like, this is peacetime, but it's the Marine Corps, which is supposed to be fighting wars. So what does the Marine Corps not fighting wars look like? And so there was a good bit of discouragement there. It's like, what is our identity? Because there's no war. And the Marine Corps is kind of like, I mean, there's a lot of kind of cliche images to describe what the Marine Corps is like, but it very much is kind of like the half abused dog that's chained up, and it's like everybody's kind of miserable and you're kept there on that edge of being really frustrated and miserable, which is a great thing when that's can be unleashed at something, but if it's not being unleashed, it's kind of devouring itself. So that's kind of what those first few years felt like, just kind of a, it felt purposeless, and there was just a general frustration with what is our, my, you know, the identity as a Marine when there's no war, essentially. That changed when I received orders to 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, because I received those orders knowing it's because they need NCOs. I was a corporal at the time. I wasn't set for a deployment, and so they were able to pull me, and I knew that they needed bodies for a deployment. So I get those orders. I'm now going to a unit where now all the training is explicitly because there is a deployment happening. So that was both helpful and a good lesson in actually how difficult it can be to overcome mindsets that you get stuck in. So a lot of those frustrations, they didn't just disappear. And it took time to try to kind of work through those. But the training was much more pointed. Like I knew there was a deployment coming.
Can you give us an example of something that they had you do then that you hadn't done before?
Well, it's funny that it's not necessarily that the activities were dramatically different, actually. It's very much just that before, like we did some good training in 2nd LAR. We spent a month in California doing desert training. And I watched what the Marine Corps can do to a desert when it's just given free rein and a bunch of ammo. So there was good training. It's not the activity, but the fact that this activity is very obviously geared towards the deployment and actually going overseas and potentially doing something. So it was more that the end was visible in a way that it hadn't been before. I was an anti-tank missile gunner, so I was mounted the whole time. LAR is mounted in vehicles, light armor. And then when I went to 1-8, I was in, they had just started switching over from the Humvee to the new JLTV. So I was mounted again. And so the activity was fairly similar. The training, a lot of what's called bulldogging, but essentially bounding online to assault a position with vehicles. So that was actually fairly similar.
But then you have to go over there and do it. How did you feel about that idea?
I mean, I was pretty excited. This was the last year of my enlistment that this deployment was happening. And so for the first like 2.5 years, I had spent thinking, this is never going to happen. I'm never going to deploy at all. So I was pretty excited. There was no specific mission in terms of like combat mission that we knew of. So we were going to be sailing with the Navy, kind of doing training with foreign nations, kind of relationship building, and then just being that force overseas in case something happened. But we didn't know that anything was going to happen beforehand. So, but it was still exciting. Like the new experiences, spending time on a Navy ship, like what's that like? How miserable is that going to be?
Training was it miserable?
Yes. Yeah. So it's not like the best lifestyle. However, my section was possibly the most spoiled it could have been in that situation. We were on the smallest ship, which for us meant that the COVID restrictions, like mask wearing and stuff, went away fastest, because once we were at sea for a certain amount of time, the population isn't changing, so and nobody's getting sick, so you can take the masks off and stuff like that. So life in that way, which the COVID restrictions are just extremely obnoxious, that relaxed for us faster than any of the other ships. Mm-hmm. There's less people. Yeah, it's smaller, but there's less people around, which I personally appreciate. The berthing that we were in, my section was put in an 18-man berthing. So we didn't have to share with anyone else. It was just our 18 guys from my section, which was just incredible. And then a number of guys played music. We were able to bring some guitars, which was brilliant. And so it was just us in our berthing with our instruments, and it worked out very nicely.
Greg Whalen plays his guitar quite a bit these days. In fact, this month he performed a special song he wrote at quite a few events honoring veterans. The inspiration came out of his experience as a Marine in Afghanistan and a tragic day that he was there for. We'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
The red, white, and blue folding nice and neat.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a different twist today. Longtime listeners know that the vast majority of veterans we've met over the years on this program served in World War II. But today, it's our latest generation of veterans, represented by 25-year-old Marine Corps vet Greg Whalen of Hillsdale, Michigan. His song, 19, was inspired by his time in Afghanistan. But so far, in what he's shared of his Marine Corps journey, he hadn't quite left the U.S.
I did training in some of these places, others I didn't, but the whole unit went to England. Well, so my ship, I guess, some of the ships went to different places. But my ship went to England, Portugal, Spain, Crete, and then we went from there. So after we finished the Mediterranean area, we went into 5th Fleet, which is the Middle East, and we did training in Jordan. We stopped in Bahrain. We spent a lot of time in Kuwait, and by the time we were there, it was because we knew there was possibly, you know, the mission we might be sent to Afghanistan. And then we touched Afghanistan, and I say Qatar just to add another name to the list, but that was like, we landed there on the way to Afghanistan. We were there for 2 hours on the tarmac. Doesn't count.
You know, there are a lot of different elements of the war in Afghanistan and a lot of different time periods that would end up with a very different experience. Can you help us understand the timing of when you got there, what you understand your mission is, and what unfolded from there?
Overall, it was very confusing to me. So we had been deployed since about February, March of 2021. It was now July, mid-July, we got off the boats into Kuwait, went to an Air Force base because we were hearing we might need to go to Afghanistan for to help with the evacuation, the withdrawal, whatever's happening there. We spent a full month in Kuwait sitting there. We knew the deadline was August 31st for America to be out, so we're getting into August now. And we're like, we're still not going, so that doesn't bode. We're probably not going to go. I remember seeing on a TV there on the base something like, you know, the evacuation is 98% complete. For some reason, that number has just stuck in my head. And so I was like, oh, we're definitely not going. It's already like August 12th. That's about when we got the orders to actually go, August 12th or 13th. The deadline being the 31st. So, I mean, kind of the adrenaline rush and that just that moment of it's actually getting real is just a very, I don't know, a unique feeling. Obviously nothing I had experienced before, but very intense. It got pretty fast paced very quickly. We had been ready and staged and packed, but it was starting to move to buses, to move to the planes. So it got hectic very quickly. In terms of our mission, we had no idea what it was going to look like on the ground at all. The first wave of Marines that went in got stuck there without any reinforcements, able to fly in for like another day or two. Because right after they got there, the airport, the Hamid Karzai International Airport, was overrun by the civilian Afghanis trying to get out. And we couldn't take off or land any planes because it was just completely covered with people. And so those, that first wave of Marines, like, I don't remember exactly how long, but they were there for a good day, 2 days, totally just trying to clear so that we could even bring in anybody else to help with anything. That was one of the worst feelings I've ever experienced, was sitting still in Kuwait, like by the tarmac, ready to get on a plane for like a day, another day, knowing that they needed help and that we could not do anything about it. So that even increased the mystery of what is the situation on the ground going to be. And I guess just in terms of the general mission, it was like, I knew we were going to be helping people get out. Other than that, I had absolutely no idea what to expect.
And you've, you know, given us a couple references to some of the inner turmoil or the seeming conflicts, the contradictions that you were wrestling with what you signed up for and what things are looking like in actuality. But just the fact that all these civilians are so desperate to get out that they're covering the airport so you can't even land, does that make you question why this is happening and why American forces are leaving?
Yes. I mean, there were a lot of questions. One of the first being, please, let's get there. These guys need our help. The second was, it's mid-August. Everything looked like this mission was done. The news, the fact that we waited this long to go, everything looked like it was done. What is going on? I remember seeing something about, like, it was at least reported in the news, like, hey, the Taliban are not going to reach, sometime that earlier that year, like, the Taliban is going to take them like 3 months to get to Kabul. Because obviously we started seeing them, you know, taking section by section. It's going to take them 3 months. And 3 days after I saw that announcement, I saw the Taliban are in the city, in Kabul. So there's just a ton of questions like, how did we get that wrong? Like, am I supposed to believe that the American intelligence services guessed that incorrectly? And then it's obviously a desperate situation. We need to get there so that we can help. But overall, yeah, like what is going on? Are we going to be able to? I guess at the time I didn't know enough to be asking, like, how are we going to get them out and everything like that. But I was just very confused about how it got to the situation it was, because it went from 98% complete to we can't even get to our own boys on the ground right now.
It sounds pretty chaotic, pretty bewildering.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you handle all that, and what happened next?
That's where I've got to give credit to, honestly, the training of the Marine Corps and even the ways in which it kind of keeps you on edge just in normal everyday life as a Marine, which is part of what's so frustrating. But what actually ended up helping in that situation, because it's like, who the heck knows what's going on? You were just waiting, like, literally second by second for the next order. Like, the second the runway gets clear or anything, like, we're getting on planes. We're fairly used to that, because actually in normal training and everything, that's kind of how things sometimes go. And so you just cling to the guys around you, to the equipment that you know you're supposed to use and keep track of, and to your immediate chain of command for any orders that they pass to you. And the second you receive an order, you do it. And it's funny that in a situation like that, receiving an order while garrison Marine Corps being here in the States on base, you kind of like, can we, you know, sometimes you're like, can we get off work? Like, I don't want another order. Like, let us go. In that situation, it was like, all I want is an order. I want something to do. Like, please give me something to do. So you kind of actually withdraw from the headspace of, like, the big picture. And it just becomes very, this is where you have to end up fighting tunnel vision. But it gets very much more like that, just the small scale. What are my immediate orders? Who do I need? Like, who am I in charge of around me and what equipment, that kind of thing.
So what were those orders?
So we get to Afghanistan. My section landed, I think it was like super early in the morning of maybe the 14th, like 1 a.m. or something. We get there and we're a mounted unit again. We didn't bring any vehicles, but there's a bunch there. And so one of the first things was we got issued like a section of a barracks building because that airport was also like a NATO base. So there were like kind of military sections of it. So we take our equipment, we set up stuff in some of those barracks rooms, and then it very quickly turned to, we need to find vehicles, start setting them up, get our guns set up on the trucks, and then we're being tasked out with sections of the airport to start patrolling while mounted. So very quickly, our command broke us up into essentially like a patrolling section, a quick reaction force on standby, sitting by the trucks basically in case something happens, and then a rest rotation. So we kind of broke into those three. That was like the general idea and the structure. We somewhat maintained that, although it very quickly just turned into, we have guys out patrolling. The QRF, the quick reaction force, is needed somewhere, so they're out. So now the rest cycle is the QRF. So it was like that for a little bit. And then we spent, my section in particular and Red section, one of the other sections, ended up spending a lot of time at Eastgate. So not only, we started mixing in, some of us are patrolling in trucks, and then some of us are actually manning some of these gates. Again, it was, everything is just moment by moment. But that was generally where kind of we were positioned.
And can you describe that scene, that environment for us?
So for the patrolling of vehicles, that was primarily what we had trained, being in a weapons company. That's a lot of what we had done. Obviously, a new setting, an unknown setting. I remember one of the weirdest kind of gut check moments was, we're setting up our truck, we're getting ready to go. I'm the vehicle commander for my truck, so we're having everybody get in, and the gunner gets up in the turret, pops his head through. You know, I mean, he's chest and above, just exposed out of the turret. And he was my buddy, whom I had been in the same boot camp company with. We had done essentially everything together. He and I had received orders from 2nd LAR 218 on the same exact day. I had just been to his wedding not long before, and it just hit. So thanks be to God, nothing ended up happening. But it did just hit, like, I, as a vehicle commander, I'm essentially ordering this guy to get in the turret. And it's like, this is my buddy, and he's the most exposed person in this whole truck. And it was just like, yep, this is real. Just kind of another realization of that. But so driving around, essentially people jumping over the walls, that kind of patrolling was a combination of sitting places, watching down like these long stretches of the wall, just to watch for people, getting out of the trucks or slowly driving as some of our dismounts get out and search different areas. There were a lot of storage containers, stuff like that. And so that's generally what that was. The gate was completely different. We would go to the gate. I was primarily to East Gate. We would go to the gate, set up, and then it really just changed depending on whether we were bringing people in or whether we had closed the gate and had stopped all movement like that. The bringing people in, the gate opened inwards, and so we had to take a huge truck and park it just inside of the gate, so it could only be opened about 2 feet. Because I remember at a certain point, like we could bring one person in at a time, and just because the gate starts opening, the whole crowd just crushes forward.
So there's still just a giant swarm of people outside the gate?
Yeah, just completely jam-packed in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all completely desperate, and so when the gate opens, everyone's trying to get in. So that caused problems with, this is where that photo of the baby being pulled over the wall, being handed up and pulled over the wall, comes from, because there were a lot of pregnant women there were a lot of young children and infants. And everybody, it's very hot during the day, and everybody's crushing and pushing and pulling. And so families like that, they were handing their kids up in the hopes that, as assuming, you know, hopefully they get through, they can pick their kid up on the other side. But at least if not, the kid is in good hands. So that's kind of, yeah, that's kind of that situation. And it ended up being the case that, so we've got the people on the outside, we're trying to bring them in, we have to search them, and then set them in a staging area for buses to take them to the terminal. Well, buses were not coming to our gate to take them for the terminal for days. So we have this growing group of people, I'm confident numbering well over 1,000 people, on the inside of our gate that we are needing to feed and water, and then contain also, because it's hot during the day and they're just sitting there for days, and it's cold during the night, and they don't have, they're fleeing the country, so they don't have stuff all that much. So that's on the inside with us. We've got the crowd on the outside with the Taliban on the outside getting mad at us because we're not moving people along, because everybody's just getting grumpy, understandably. And I mean, yeah. So we're like stuck in this awkward, the gate is like this awkward middle ground between these two potential mobs. And we're like just kind of trying to appease and control both. And then at a certain point, we received orders that our gate was not going to open again, period. And so that also turns into, I mean, how do you like present that to this massive crowd of people outside who are desperate to leave the country? How do you control them when they start realizing it's not going to open again? So that was kind of the general situation at the gates, or at least our gate. I assume it was fairly similar at some of the others.
I don't know if there's any Marine Corps training for that.
We had, and this is not to criticize our battalion command at all. When we were in Kuwait, we knew that it was going to be a NEO mission, the non-combatant evacuation operation. So they set up training where we had Marines pretending to be the people fleeing the country. They set up the stations where we were being searched for weapons and anything like that. And they set up a station where they're they're practicing the paperwork side of things to get us on planes and all that. And again, this is not a criticism of our command. I actually have an extremely high opinion of our battalion command, especially seeing them during and after the actual mission. But in hindsight, it was just, it's laughable. Because what do Marines do? They get in nice straight lines and they wait their turn to go through, because this is another training thing. And it's like, that's what you do. That's, from day one, you get in nice straight lines. And so it didn't match at all. Again, that's nobody's fault. But yeah, it was very much, this is completely unprecedented for us. Even what we do train is like to kill the guys who are on the outside of the gate, the Taliban, who we're now told that they're doing crowd control on the outside and we're on the inside. Like, we exist to kill them, except not anymore. So very confusing in that regard.
How long did that feel? Did that feel like it was a lot longer than that number of days?
Yes. Yeah, it felt extremely long, especially because mostly you're just not really sleeping. And that just makes anything feel a lot longer. The rest of the time there, I spent at least half of it, if not more, at the gate, at East Gate itself. So a lot of the time was there working with the people there. And it was literally everything from getting aggressive with people when they started causing issues, to feeding and watering them, to going and finding baby formula, that somehow the medical personnel had baby formula, and getting baby formula to take to these mothers in the crowd on the inside of the gate, who we were taking care of, because with the stress, the women are not lactating. They're also they're going into labor. So there are babies being born. Like, the doctors, the Navy doctors there are like delivering babies like most of this time, as well as dealing with other injuries and everything. So it's like the full spectrum of like medical and personal issues, literally having conversations with people who could, if they could speak English a little bit, trying to comfort them or answer their questions. Yeah, just a wild variety of things going on. And then the patrolling in the vehicles, that was more kind of standard stuff that we had trained for, except there's not really any training that prepares for when you're actually, you do find somebody who jumped over the wall and you're now collecting them, searching them, figuring out what needs to be done with them.
Still to come, this Marine's memories from August 26th, 2021, a day 13 Americans and hundreds of Afghan civilians lost their lives. How he feels about it now and why he's written a song to honor their memory. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different twist this week. We're taking a break from our usual focus on older veterans, mostly from the World War II generation, and hearing from one just about a quarter of their age. When we left off, Marine Corps veteran Greg Whalen was describing the very unpredictable situation he faced at Hamid Karzai Airport in Afghanistan in August of 2021.
I remember one moment in particular. A number of nations had bits and pieces of their military there to help. I remember one moment I was speaking with a Canadian spec ops guy, and at the time, flights had been grounded again. I'm not exactly sure why, but they had been grounded. And I remember us kind of like joking, just like, I don't know if we're getting out of here, let alone all these people. Like, we are this tiny little pocket in this whole area of the earth. I don't know how this is going to work out. We have a single runway. And that's our whole plan. There were moments of kind of morbid humor where you spend some time thinking about that. There were moments where I remember hearing buddies of mine, just overhearing them in conversation, saying stuff like, I wish we could do more for these people, which shocked me then and does now still, because I mean, these guys are in as bad a position as we don't really know who and when anybody's going to get out. And they're just so caught up in how terrible a situation this is for everybody, and they wish that they could do more to help these innocent people. And that is really, really a beautiful sentiment. And then there's just the exhaustion of just keep going and doing things. I remember one night, I had an opportunity to lie down for maybe an hour or two. So I'm going, I left the gate, I got replaced. I'm going to lie down in one of the trucks and get some sleep. As I'm about to get in the truck, I just happen to look down the road and I see these dark shapes scurrying across the road. I'm like, oh no, I just lost all my sleep tonight. So I, you know, you go grab a guy because you're not just, you can't just go to bed. So you go grab a guy. We ended up over the next hour, it was like 23 people. Wow. We routed out from that area, and just that kind of thing. Is you just keep doing things.
And is there part of you that wonders how and when this is going to end?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you wrestle with that?
I mean, going in knowing that the 31st was the deadline. However, the idea of a deadline starts to just be utterly absurd in that situation. And then there were instances where the Taliban threatened to start shooting at Eastgate, threatened to start shooting if we didn't start bringing people in through the gate. Now, I don't actually believe that they would have, and we didn't open the gate. I don't think they would have because they are winning. All they have to do is sit there long enough and we're leaving. So they had already won. They didn't need to attack. That would have been very stupid. But, I mean, for us, it's like, we hear that. We have guys on the just on the outside of the gate mm-hmm. as a show of force to keep people calm. One of them starts running back to the gate saying, hey, the Taliban are saying they're going to start shooting. Well, for us, we're all lining up on the gate immediately. We're ready. Like, this is going to be a disaster. Tons of innocent people are just going to get butchered in the crossfire here. Because, and I you know, I hope this isn't too much, but what I can promise is that every single Marine who can possibly get out of this gate and get his barrel out of his buddy's back towards the Taliban is going to be just pulling the trigger as fast as he can. And there's the Taliban are individuals in this massive crowd of people. Like, inevitably, it's going to be terrible.
The collateral damage is going to
be horrible.
Yeah.
So that was very much on our mind. Like, what's going to happen? Is this going to turn into... and kind of in our frustration and anger, I think there were moments where we kind of wished that this would turn into, all right, we are, this HKIA is ground zero for retaking the entire city of Kabul so that we can set our terms on how this whole thing is going to go down. Obviously, that would have been a disaster. Tons of people would have died in that situation. But all of those questions or options are in our minds, wondering what's going to happen.
What did happen? What did it feel like then, and how do you feel about it now?
The bombing at Abbey Gate was the biggest event of that evacuation. It was completely surreal as we started hearing that that had happened. One of the weird things is I don't actually even remember hearing the explosion go off, which seems completely wrong to me. I mean, there were shots and explosions the whole time we were there. Almost nonstop, but I don't know where I was that I wouldn't have heard that one. But we started hearing the details of what happened, and it's just totally surreal. And we don't know what the follow-on actions are going to be. And honestly, in hindsight, the way things just kind of continued to wind down, and then eventually I found myself on a plane a few days later flying out. It just made that sense of being surreal even more intense. I don't really know how to describe it. It just was like suddenly over, and we were just like, we're just leaving. It didn't, you know, talk about anticlimactic. There wasn't really a conclusion, honestly. It just kind of all of that stuff happening, and then these Marines, the soldier and the corpsman get killed, and then we kind of just fly out.
Yeah, and maybe some people have heard about the explosion and the price of it, and some haven't, but I'm guessing that when that happens, there's got to be a desire among fellow Marines to strike back, but there's no real way to do that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, especially given our orders, there was nothing, it'd be very clear, there was nothing, no retaliation on our end that was planned or going to happen.
Your hands are tied.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, with time, that kind of frustration about that situation has only increased given what has come out about the situation leading up to the explosion and during and after. The amount of information we had about that event before it actually happened is infuriating. And I hope that certain people are able to speak up about it in the near future, because it's just completely, I believe it's just completely wrong how it all happened and what our reaction was. I'm not saying that we should have just invaded the country again because of that.
I think I hear you saying it could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's always that risk. So, you know, I'm not one to try to claim like there should never be death at all when you're in a situation like that. I mean, obviously I would hope there wouldn't be, but I think this situation in particular was handled in such a way that it absolutely could have and should have been avoided.
That makes you wonder if those fellow Marines, corpsmen, died unnecessarily, mm-hmm. died in vain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And even given their families and the congressional hearings that have happened in the years since, and the remarkable lack of answers or accountability that's come from anybody to them about it, really has only increased, unfortunately, has increased that sense of, so what was the point, though? There haven't really been answers given about what happened. There's kind of a general, like, the mission was a success. We saved a lot of people. And while I don't want to detract from what the guys who were there did, that was one of the first things and I think most important things that our battalion command did or said right afterwards. Our sergeant major told the whole battalion, like, do not get caught up in the political swirl surrounding what just happened. What you guys did personally and in the moment was incredible. Don't confuse that with any of the politics. And that has stuck with me that he said that. And I think that's been really important for myself. And I would argue for a lot of other guys, because letting ourselves get caught up in the politics of it is when you can go down a really dark path with that thought of, but it was unnecessary that any of them died. What about all the suffering of the Afghan people, what we saw and experienced, whatever. I think that was some of the greatest advice was, you can't get caught. Like, remember those moments where it's like, yep, I got that mother baby formula, so her child ate that night.
Mm-hmm.
And like, don't confuse that too much with what the heck was our Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, maybe President, what were they doing? Like, those are not the same thing, and to kind of let them be separate in a way.
Two things can be true at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That a big picture view of the situation leaves something to be desired, but with the orders you had and your responsibility, you lived up to everything that was asked of you. Is that how you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something, and I want to thank you for being willing to share this with us. Of course, thank you for serving our country. Is there something that you would like to see happen that would make you feel any differently about this?
I don't believe, obviously, that the past could be undone in any way. But in a situation like that, the most that can be done is to see leaders take responsibility for the things that happen under their charge. So I'm not, you know, on some vindictive war path. I think it's far too complex for at least me in my position to try to pin down who is at fault here. So I'm not even going to try to throw names out there. But when something goes badly like that, the most that can happen, or at least the first thing that needs to happen, is that leaders, you know, own up to what happened, try to explain why or how things happened the way they did. In terms of the aftermath, I just don't even begin to know how you... There's still people over there who we had promised that we would help out. I don't know how we go about fixing that situation. Obviously, I think we have a duty to, as a nation, if we're going to be making promises to people and they're risking their lives by working with us, we owe them something. I just don't know what fixing that would look like. There's a lot of beautiful memorials happening for those who were killed, and a lot of organizations like the Operation Allies Refuge Foundation who are working on compiling the histories of what happened, honoring those who deserve it, and trying to keep up the conversation between everybody who was there and who wasn't, to remember, to memorialize. And I think those are really beautiful and important things.
And I can't let you go with asking you to look ahead a little bit, because you've been looking back and reflecting mm-hmm. on an experience you never planned on, an experience that none of the rest of us have had. And I hope people do research some of what you're talking about. There's a lot more they can learn online about those who died and, mm-hmm. and everything that's happening. But for you personally, now you're in college now. I've heard you talk a lot about leadership, good and bad. Why do I have the sense that you've got your eye on some leadership positions in the future?
So I had been thinking of going back into the Marine Corps as an officer, this time commissioning with my degree. But I have recently determined against that, actually. So I'm not going to be going active duty again. I'm happy to see the good people who are from Hillsdale, especially, who are going in. That's an encouragement to me, absolutely. I don't have a big picture yet for what I'm going to do. Kind of a more immediate thing, this is kind of random, but in terms of this in particular, I recently put out some music that I wrote about kind of in memory of these events. And I've actually been in contact with a number of people who I've been invited to come play at some of these memorial events for some of the people who were there. So I guess, I mean, I do see that as a form of leadership, trying to get the message out there to remember and connect with people about it. But longer term, I don't really have an idea yet.
That's okay. We started out talking about why you went into the Marine Corps mm-hmm. and the esteem with which you held the ideals of America. Mm-hmm. Has how you see all that and how you engage with it changed at all? How do you feel about your country and military service now?
I think that we are farther from those ideals than perhaps we've ever been, but that also means that those ideals are more important for us now than maybe they've ever been. Again, I'm encouraged by seeing good people go in the military. I think it's theoretically possible to get to a point where actually serving in the military could not be justified, even on like a moral ground. I don't think that we're there yet. I think it is a hard time that needs good people to fight it out. So, those ideals, I don't think they're necessarily being practiced all that much, especially in the bureaucracy itself, in the government. But there are a lot of good people still in the country, and those ideals are absolutely worth fighting for. So I hope that good people continue to join, weighing it prudently, obviously. But I think I naturally tend towards a more pessimistic view of things. But even just what that mission showed me, the quality of the Marines around me, the fact that they were able to say, you know, that they were able to spend time thinking about how they wish they could do more when literally their lives were on the line and they could not do anything more. But all they were thinking about is that they, like, that just changed a lot of my perspective in a very positive way. So I absolutely have hope. And if it comes kind of a grassroots, like the quality of the people going in, if they can make a difference, it's worth fighting for.
And I want to ask one more clarifying question, mm-hmm. and I hope I say this right, because I think there's a reflex and a tendency culturally for people to want to make all this political. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about a subject like this, then it's going to be criticizing one political party or another, or one leader or another. And, you know, enemies always want an adversary divided. Mm-hmm. And politically, there's no question America has been quite divided. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, though, that in the Marine Corps, you didn't ask those other guys in your battalion who they voted for in November, and you weren't going to make a decision about saving his life based on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely not at all. The situation like that, life in the Marine Corps, helps to really dramatically show you the equality of everybody's, their value in life. Like the idea of racism is like, it can't exist when everybody is soaking wet, sleeping in the same mud hole as everybody else. Like, we're getting the same treatment. You know, it levels the playing field. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Greg Whalen, a different perspective from what we're used to hearing, but an important one. Greg's song, 19, is on multiple music platforms, and I do have the entire song linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're going to hear a bit of it here in closing after I say thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today and say those four words we should never forget. Freedom is not free.
I'm finally coming home, not the way I planned, not the way you want all that you get of me. The red, white, and blue folding nice and neat. I know that it isn't fair now that I'll never be there to see you and our daughter grow. You said you were proud of me, but I was just being naive. Never thought I'd die at 19. I was just 19.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.